D.A. Sky Thorleifsson presents this special edition, self-isolation episode of Adaptational. Due to the current global situation, production on the second season has been postponed until further notice. However, during this complex and difficult period of time, we hope that we can provide some entertainment for those seeking new content from old friends. And gentlemen, welcome to Adaptational. I'm Sky Thorleifsson. Normally, this is where I would give the spiel about how this show is about the stories you love and what could happen to them if they're turned into movies. Well, now I have, but also, I have a new spiel. Aside from what I had said earlier, I understand that this situation is very much easy for me as an introvert who has been training for this event his entire life, but hopefully I'm the last person to have to ask you guys to respect social distancing while medical professionals do their work. Recoveries from COVID-19 are up here in Manitoba, but that's not the case in some countries, and it's best we avoid the Orwellian doublespeak of some politicians and remain as alert as possible, while also trusting that we can all overcome this by doing, well, for once, as little as possible. Again, not very hard for people like me. Wow, is this what it's like to be the popular kid in school? It's nice. Man, I wish it could last. Anyway, in order to give you some relief from the monotony, I'm here to give you a session with just myself and my taste in adaptations, or what used to be. Ever since this show started, I've been aware of its status in a very niche market. Most people I know or watch who talk about adaptations just debate the qualities of completed adaptations, rather than theorize what could happen to the unfilmable books. Those that are considered unadaptable or cursed or just taking way too long to happen. I've been interested in this idea since about 2014, but it had to have spawned from something that wasn't so abstract, something that was more aspirational. Today, I'm looking back on my own history with the adaptation process. I, like most writers, have had lofty goals for where my career is going to go, and what I would do with certain properties. I wanted to dissect why I wanted to adapt those stories in the first place, whether I'll ever get the chance to in the future, and in some cases, why I should have let sleeping cats lie. Enough of my pondering, let's resurrect these old ideas and try to reanimate the Frankensteinian ambition like Universal does every 5 years. I won't go into immense detail about all of them, but there will be some major influences on my work, and some passing fads introduced at different times throughout. Let's begin. I've been obsessed with the idea of adaptation since I was a kid, probably as early as 7 years old. But like most kids my age, born in the 90s but not early enough to have nostalgia for them, the big watershed moment in my love of movies and the books that inspired them was my dad's insistence at the age of 8 to see this little indie darling of a film with a rather innocuous title, The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. Now, I had known about J.R.R. Tolkien's work prior to Peter Jackson's films, mostly thanks to the animated TV specials of The Hobbit and The Return of the King by Rankin Bass, and the now quite infamous 1978 film The Lord of the Rings, directed by Ralph Bakshi. But I never really thought about them as books that existed outside of the confines of the tiny black TV screen. So the revelation that somebody was making the most epic movies I'd ever seen, that said movies just happened to have a name I recognized, and that not only was that name popular from cartoons, but was actually considered one of the all-time great works of literature, all of this was, to put it lightly, earth-shattering. Now, of course, I didn't read The Lord of the Rings right away, but from watching the documentaries that came along with the extended editions, I learned about all the changes done to the adaptation, and I learned all the filmmakers' justifications for them. So when I did read the books later in life, I remained intensely loyal to both Tolkien's text and to my love of Jackson's movies, not just as groundbreaking cinema, but as vital parts of my personality. And the act of adapting said films was a major catalyst in getting me invested in filmmaking and writing as a career. To be fair, a lot of my earliest writings prior to this actually constitute a form of adaptation, mostly for the theater. Some early ideas for stage adaptations that I had were quite out there as far as their potential in a small town with a limited number of theater geeks and an even more limited funds. A very early influence for me was the BBC documentary series Walking with Dinosaurs, which was the first show I watched where I felt like I was being taken seriously as an audience member, without any condescension or childish pandering. And in what is going to become a rather familiar pattern, I wanted to share that level of intelligence and intrigue with the world. So I started transcribing Kenneth Branagh's narration on sheets of paper with the intent of staging the documentary as a live theatrical show, even going so far as to get my parents to help craft masks and puppets out of paper bags for each of the animals. A little later on, approximately grade 5, I also transcribed a streamlined version of A Charlie Brown Christmas, which of course I knew every word to, and pitched that as a piece to perform in the elementary school Christmas show. Of course, these ideas went nowhere. For some reason, my Charlie Brown script was voted off the island by my peers at school, and instead of staging WWD on a non-existent budget, my dad took me to see the arena show that was touring North America at the time, and was the coolest thing in the world to see live, even when the writing was childish by comparison. But by the time LOTR came out and I was utterly convinced of my intent as a filmmaker, it only stood to reason to me that this was what great filmmakers did. Take something classic and iconic, translate it to the screen with some personal touches, and win all the Academy Awards in the world. So it only made sense to jump on the bandwagon by trying to adapt the classic fantasy works of Tolkien's drinking buddy. Thus we encounter our first subject, the first story I ever obsessed over adapting, The Chronicles of Narnia. C.S. Lewis was my first real literary icon, because The Chronicles of Narnia were the first books I read on my own, and the first books that spoke to me as an individual, and gave me a vision that felt like it was meant almost exclusively for me. So while all the other kids at school were waiting for their ticket to platform 9 3/4, I would thumb my nose at them, while desperately searching for a hidden portal in my closet. Anyway, fueled by Jackson's vision of Lord of the Rings and my deepening admiration for Lewis, I started developing the world of Narnia as I saw it. A world of elegance and intrigue where some children were welcome, either because they were needed there or because they needed it. Filled with mythic creatures, some from the original books and some taken from an encyclopedia of fairies that my parents owned. So we had the classic mythical creatures like giants, centaurs, and minotaurs, standing alongside strange beasts like the shape-shifting black dog known as the Bargost. Of course, that probably indicates something of a contrast between my vision and the vision of Narnia that most people have. For me, Narnia was a safe haven, but more often than not, it still maintained a sense of danger. Because Lewis's books were not simply a child's ideal escape. They were fraught with dangerous figures and forces that would strike if you let your guard down. You can see this in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but also more prevalently in The Silver Chair and the traumatizing final chapter of the series, fittingly called The Last Battle. My ultimate intention was to emulate that whenever it was most consistent with the tone of the 7 original books. And yes, I mean all 7. Because of course one man would be allowed to direct every single one of those films. I was absolutely convinced that this was the right way to do this, and that everyone in the world would love it. Everyone, that is, except for Disney. You can see where this is going. In 2005, Disney released their version of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, directed by Andrew Adamson of Shrek fame. Now, to be fair, the film that was released did justice overall to the book it was based on, featuring impressive visual effects and 2 killer performances by Tilda Swinton and Liam Neeson, probably the best incarnation of both the White Witch and Aslan I could ask for. But as someone who was set on emphasizing the intrigue and mood that the books had given me, their version of this film, at least for me, felt less iconic than it should be. Aside from the scene at the stone table, which is suitably grim and creepy, the whole thing feels almost too light and too pretty. The problem isn't that it was meant to be brutal, but the film, and especially the major action sequences, lack a distinctive look and tone, awash with bright colors and featuring an epic battle taking place in broad daylight. Also, even as a kid, I felt that the dialogue was thinly written. In Lewis's writing, he wasn't condescending to his readers, emulating childlike wonder without sounding childish. The writing in this film feels kind of twee, like the writers were trying to make the characters sound clever or smart when a lot of the time it's cringy.
There's a prophecy. With Adam's flesh and Adam's bone, sits at Caer Peribel in throne. The evil time will be over and done.
You know, that doesn't really rhyme.
Yeah, I know it don't, but look, you're kind of missing the point.
Surprisingly, I think that the film series peaked with the 2nd film, Prince Caspian, where it embraced that mood and intrigue, even at the expense of loyalty to the events of the novel. Granted, Caspian was always my least favorite book in the series, which is probably why the film surprised me way more. Sadly, I had the adverse reaction to the adaptation of my favorite book in the series. The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is a masterpiece. I will fight people who say otherwise. And it's great because it's different from the other plot-heavy stories in the series, more akin to an episodic epic like The Odyssey, where the characters and your connection to them drives you forward while their reason for being there essentially takes a back seat. When Disney finally made it there, they sucked all the vision out of it for the sake of moving blandly towards another average action climax involving a prophecy about magic swords, the fate of Narnians everywhere, and me not giving a damn unless the dragon was on screen. Can you tell I cared about this a lot? I mean, it should be pretty obvious. So obvious, in fact, that it shouldn't surprise you that I had started writing an adaptation of my own. Dawn Treader was my first real taste of adaptational ambition. I loved the book so much that in 2004, I started writing a script lifted almost word for word from Lewis's original text. Again, for the stage. Because who needs money when you can have an amazing set with a full ship and everything? Well, it didn't get made anyway. I made it as far as the midpoint, but then my interest in the project dwindled as I moved on to other ideas. After Narnia, I obviously had to explore more fantasy realms to see if I connected with them. But to say I rejected every popular franchise of the time is an overstatement. Just those that everyone else liked that had no ties to actually awesome stuff. Like whatever Tolkien wrote about. So while I rejected one popular franchise about teenage wizards, one about a teenage dragon rider was not off the table. Aragorn and the rest of Christopher Pellini's inheritance cycle were first introduced to me by my sister, who seemed to like the books well enough, and it wasn't Harry Potter, so I thought, I'll give it a go. Like any 12-year-old with a minuscule attention span, I lost interest when I learned that the main character was 3 years my senior. My interest in him as a primary character was ruined, and I didn't finish it, so I just watched the movie and then forgot about it for a year and a half. And then remembered, oh hey, everybody hates the movie, so why not see if the original was any better? Spoiler alert, it was. Aragorn was definitely a fad that relied on the popularity of Tolkien and George Lucas in order to sell its story, but I didn't mind so much because I want a dragon! That's the dopest thing in the world! Why can't I have one? What did irritate me, though, was how lame Aragorn himself was in comparison to everything about his circumstances. On this level, Harry Potter fans and I had one thing in common. Love the story, hate the main character. Aragorn is obviously written to be a teenager, and that's what I hate about him. He's whiny and titled and just won't take a hint about his elven lady love's total lack of interest in him. Come on, you chuck your fantasy world full of quirky characters like a dragon with a drinking tendency and a sarcastic hippie soothsayer who owns a frickin' werecat! And this obnoxious know-it-all lacking in self-awareness is your main character? You can tell I'm harping on my major criticisms of these books, and it may make you wonder, well then why would you want to adapt these into films, especially after the last disaster piece? Honestly, I don't really know. Part of it may have been the idea that this guy had started writing these books when he was 15 years old, and somehow his novels got a big enough following that it gave me hope as an aspiring artist. Mostly, though, it was probably the high-minded assumption that I could tell this story better than the hacks behind this movie. I even had two friends who wanted to get involved whenever we decided to adapt it again. Most likely to television, because that would allow us to fit in every nuance that we thought was vital to the story. We were pulling a Game of Thrones before Game of Thrones did. With less bare cleavage, of course. We had some dignity. But much like last time, my interest waned and something significant prevented me from feeling like I should make this adaptation. Or rather, something significant didn't happen. I have never finished reading the last book in the series. I wanted to have a satisfying ending, but Inheritance, the final novel in the quartet, forgot what forward momentum was, and also didn't bother to give a glossary so that I could remind myself who all these extraneous characters were and why I should care about them when they inevitably die. I could not concentrate past the 200-page mark, and I gave up on it approximately in June of 2012, and I haven't gone back since. This may well be the close of the first chapter of my lofty goals as a writer of adaptations. The first two stories that I really felt a significant connection to came and went, one staying with me much longer than the other. At the same time, though, it also marks the end of that chapter because all of these stories gave me some ambition to start spinning my own yarns. At age 13, driven by desire to maybe outpace Pellini, I started writing my first ever novel, The Battle of the Dragon Sons, Avengers of the Last Dragon. Catchy title, I know. A piece influenced by the aforementioned authors, it was an original story about a young boy who figured himself to be exceptional among many folk. I mean, he was, since he was the son of a dragon. Don't ask how it happened, it just worked. It had all the trappings of a fantasy epic. Dwarves, elves, fairies, a pantheon of element-based dragon gods, dramatic appearances by gods from other ancient mythologies, and even a line of warriors who rode on giant prehistoric flightless birds. And just so you know, I was writing this in 2007, so anybody who used those specific type of mounts in video games since then, I thought of it before you. Big shock, 13-year-old me was not a good writer in his own right. But at least he tried something, before he quit after 10 chapters of the first in a 7-book series. Some elements of that story have lingered in my mind for years afterwards, and they may figure in later, but once again, I pressed on, continuing to search for the thing that would make my name echo throughout the ages. More on that after this ad break. Okay, now we come to the second chapter of this epic saga, what can only be described as my emo-adjacent phase. That's the best way that I could describe it, since I've never been full-blown emo, but I've always had some connection to it, whether consciously or not, mostly in my late high school years. I started to think a lot more deeply about my role as an outsider, who felt and thought way more than I figured my fellow students ever did. And I started embracing things that represented a more mature approach to storytelling, boundary-pushing narratives that rang more authentic than the cutesy stories I had consumed before, narratives that showed the world in a more poignant and or brutal light, especially the ones starring animals. We'll get to the white elephant cat in the room eventually, but can I instead interest you in that horribly mangled rabbit carcass in the corner? Bright eyes, burning like fire. Bright eyes, how can we close and fail? At the age of 7, Watership Down was a, pardon the pun, watershed moment for my taste in animated films. I had never seen a film with this level of grit, atmosphere, and thematic weight, let alone in cartoon form. And when I read the novel in 2011, it even further cemented that I absolutely adored it, and that I wanted to tell this story again in my own way. My own way being basically a word-for-word adaptation of the original Richard Adams text. In live action. With CGI rabbits. Hi, Jon Favreau, nice to meet ya. I love your work on The Lion King. Tell me, exactly how many computers did you employ to drain the life out of the characters' faces? Believe me, I am fully aware that without some major animated expression, it would have been difficult to pull this off. But the main thing that I still think would have worked was the expanded text based on Adams's writing, the folklore, the language, the backstory. To me, the expanded story would essentially take the film from being a 90-minute adventure to a far more enticing 2.5-hour saga. Hey, any great Best Picture-winning movie has to be at least that long, don't you think? This, in my mind's eye, was going to be my breakout hit. This was the shock that I would administer to the heart of cinema. It was going to win 5 Academy Awards, most notably 3 for its young, upstart writer-director-producer. It was going to open up the doors for me to a wide world of amazing opportunities that only a true cinematic genius would have been given the opportunity to embrace. Yeah, maybe it would have. Too bad it's already been done 3 times. Remaking an animated classic when it's a standalone masterpiece is not a completely unacceptable practice. But when said remake has happened twice for TV and once for the stage, it starts to take on the aura of an old hat, clearly well-loved but perhaps tainted by overexposure. This is different, in my opinion, from Little Women, because that dusty old doorstop came out in the 1800s. Even at 48 years old, Watership Down doesn't have the same clout. It's too soon for its Gerwig-esque revamp, and I'm certainly not the person to make it. My connection with the story is too closely tied to the events as depicted chronologically, whether in the novel or the film. I can't chop this baby up and try to reassemble it. It would ruin the impact of key events in the long and winding, yet haunting and beautiful narrative. With the BBC Netflix miniseries in 2018 came essentially the last echoes of my yearning to adapt this novel into a David Lean epic in miniature. Gratefully, it was not a painful loss, since I liked that miniseries for what it was. Not a generation-defining event, but a well-executed refurbishing of the story, which is much better than cold-blooded animal homicide. Speaking of which... You knew this would come up again. The movie musical that made me its bitter ex-boyfriend. Again, with the counterculture thing, everybody else worshipped Phantom of the Opera in high school, so I was gonna love Cats even more. I'm not gonna lie, the first time I watched Cats as a teenager, I was weirded out just as many other people were. I didn't get all the costume designs and the body language, to put it lightly. But between memory and the presence of certain characters, I was constantly drawn to it, trying to find the meaning of this weird experience. Is it religion? Is it trauma? Is it just some guy's massive ego trip? Well, yeah, probably that more than anything. But it's based on a long dead man's poetry. It's gotta mean something more. And more people need to know what that something is, so maybe I should try presenting it in a way that most people will actually connect with. I've already told you somewhat about how I had envisioned it. A fully CGI animated film with anthropomorphic felines, ditching the stage musical's form-fitting costume design, telling a slightly more complex story focused on faith and the true essence of living a good life, set partially inside an abandoned theater. Tom Hooper apparently only got the memo about the theater thing. And at this point, he can have it. Why would I want my name in any way associated with such a disaster? I still haven't seen Hooper's movie. I'm not planning to, but I know all the horror stories. The digital glitches, the jarring film editing, the cockroaches. Even I never thought about how to adapt the cockroaches. And it really has dawned on me since the first trailer came out that any narrative that I gave the characters in the musical was probably way more interesting to me than the product we got. It was actually theater director Trevor Nunn who initially pitched the emotional through line for the musical, which is where Grisabella and the song Memory came from. And that's still just a fraction of the show as a whole. So really, I was totally free to assume that this Jellicle Ball actually marked the last time Old Deuteronomy was going to choose which cat would go to the Heaviside Lair, and that he needed to find someone who would take his place, which is where my girl Jemima came into play. That was the narrative in my head, and if you ask me, it makes more sense than the nonsense Hooper made up about McCavity wanting to go to heaven for no reason at all. But I can take solace in this. With any luck, Hooper will not be allowed to ruin any other stories that I want to tell in my own way. Just the two that I connected with the most. Wait, two? Oh, come on! Are you even surprised at this point? High school felt like hell to me back in 2010, but I was too much of a wimp to listen to actually good rock music, so of course I listened to Les Miserables. And of course listening to it made me question how it hadn't been made into an Oscar-winning magnum opus while something like Chicago could get a wacky adaptation that everybody liked except me. I will come across as harsher than I should, because I don't hate the Les Mis movie, but suffice to say, much like with Cats, pretty much everything that Hooper did with his movie, I basically wanted to do the opposite with my supposed adaptation. Clear, fluid cinematography, grand, practical sets and locales that overwhelm you with their scale, and confident, clean vocalization. Everybody knows that Les Mis is basically the Lord of the Rings of musicals. You know, besides the Lord of the Rings musical that most people seem to have forgotten. But the point is, in order to really embrace both the size and the melodrama of the original stage show, you would need somebody like Peter Jackson, who proved he could do both when the studio wasn't strong-arming him. That was the way I wanted to see Les Mis depicted. A classic epic that could be looked back on fondly for generations. The movie we got has maybe 3 or 4 effective renditions of the songs, and some pretty decent makeup effects, and a bunch of actors that I like, mostly from seeing them either on stage or in better movies. I have very complicated feelings. I tried to accept the Les Mis movie for what it was for a few years, but as time went on and Hooper kept making movies in the same uneven style, what little curiosity I had with him grinded to a halt. I hesitate to call the movie bad, but when it could have been Lawrence of Arabia, it feels like too much of a compromise. Now, to some degree, I think about Les Mis on a different level from Cats, besides the fact that it's just a better musical overall and one that I love outside of just 2 or 3 key elements. But as far as its adaptability is concerned, I actually think very differently about their potential as remake material. The fact about Cats is that the musical is so deeply entrenched in the theater and is so divisive that it basically only had one chance to be made into a theatrical film. The film that got made turned out to be the worst it could possibly have been, but nobody is banging down doors to say, "You have to try again!" But Les Mis has an untouchable quality. A universality and respectability between both audiences and critics that doesn't really exist with Cats. When people think about the name Les Mis, they're not going to think about the movie, but the cultural landmark that is the stage musical. The film adaptation of Les Mis has not sullied its good name, which is why in 10 to 20 years' time, I would not be surprised if they took a second stab at it, probably with a very different style. Will I get to make it? I mean, I have some pretty decent mental storyboards, but that depends on how far my career goes after all the complaining I've done today. Well, I can dream the dream, can't I? Every adaptation that you want to make when you're a teenager is a big-name, ambitious idea that's going to be the coolest thing in the world to make if you're the one making it. Then, whenever it does get made, it ranges from mildly to horrifically disappointing. I've often made fun of Harry Potter fans for blowing up about changes made to the movies that are at worst mild inconveniences for non-fans like myself, but you never really know what it feels like until it's your baby and the government never told you it was up for adoption. Which is why, as these new adaptations came and went, I tried to compensate for them with some mildly broader ideas based on public domain works. There were 2 other projects that I considered adapting when I was younger. Being raised in a Mennonite church, I of course had to pick one biblical tale, and mine was going to be Esther, but Passion of the Christ style, where everyone spoke in Persian and ancient Hebrew. Also, probably way less conservative than Mel Gibson's movie. And the other was a weird, non-musical adaptation of Mozart's The Magic Flute, but starring the culture and characters of Nordic mythology. I didn't really think that one through. They're both essentially just Lord of the Rings clones, because that's how I measured all my cinematic standards. Until, of course, Pan's Labyrinth happened. You've heard my Guillermo del Toro narrative already, and aside from the fact that I finally watched both Chronos and Mimic for the first time fairly recently, nothing at all has changed. Del Toro is my icon. He is the filmmaker I want to be like. Moody, dark, grisly, but deeply sincere in his writing. And it was thanks to Pan's Labyrinth that I came to finally understand the definition of the words original screenplay. Del Toro wasn't simply transcribing a pre-existing source, he was incorporating all his influences from both his upbringing and his love of monster movies and fairy tales, and molding them into a story that was all his own, with original characters, a time period that I had never seen depicted before, and themes about maturation and defiance against authority. Even with all these disparate influences, this wasn't a clone, this was new. And it was told with utter confidence by a man who had lived with the characters in his head for the longest time. That was the true watershed moment for me. I wanted to be able to say, I did that. I didn't want to do my own version of Del Toro's story. I wanted to tell something that did everything he did without directly aping anyone. I would not make my version of Pan's Labyrinth. I would make my Pan's Labyrinth. I don't know if I've gotten there yet. I tried for a while to tell a story that was of my own creation, but more often than not, it was taking some note or other from this movie or that book or this anything. Just think about the aforementioned novel that I wanted to write at age 13, which was just a Lord of the Rings, Aragorn, Age of Mythology clone. Even years later, when I tried to reboot that story and tell it anew, mostly I was just trying to craft a grim mesh of Mad Max and The Revenant. Just trying to do the popular thing without really saying, does this reflect how I personally feel? No, this would never do. If I was going to tell a story in response to something, it couldn't just be for the sake of trying to do the popular thing. It had to be raw, as if it was real to nobody else. And somehow, some way, it needed to push a boundary. Well, Del Toro answered that call as well. Something that always fascinated me about Del Toro was his intent in telling stories visually, and that one day he wanted to make an almost purely silent movie, just actors relying on physical expression in order to tell the story. The closest that he ever came to achieving that goal was with his other major Oscar winner, The Shape of Water, a gorgeous, poignant love story about two characters who can only express through their physicality. And while I love that movie, some part of me still felt let down by the ever-prevalent use of dialogue by the other characters, justified thematically by its use to further isolate its main characters, but still failing to capture what I thought could be a defining moment in cinema history, where a storyteller used their respective media to tell a story that could only be told through said media. Thus came Echo, the audio drama through which I launched my still not entirely successful career, started as a response to Del Toro's ambition. Instead of telling the story solely through imagery, I was going to tell it solely through dialogue and atmosphere. Instead of having a mute person as the main character, the use of dialogue and exposition to describe the character's surroundings would be justified by the main character being blind. They needed to listen in order to understand, and in order to survive. Obviously, Echo and The Shape of Water are not meant to be direct analogs. Athos, the stone monster, is not a direct stand-in for the amphibious man, for example. But Del Toro's influence, his love of monsters and mythos, is etched into the fabric of the story, as are my other major influences. World building recalling Tolkien, themes inspired by Ingmar Bergman, dialogue reminiscent of screenwriter Robert Bolt, and a structure broadly lifted from Dante's Divine Comedy. More than anything, though, I wanted this story to reflect my connection to these creators and the characters they fashioned. So while none of the characters are a direct analog for the Faun from Pan's Labyrinth, something of what the character meant to me is woven into the script. I don't know if this is what I'd call my Pan's Labyrinth, but it represents a step towards finding it. Because I poured everything that mattered to me as a writer at that time into this script, it is the purest manifestation of something I strove to tell. If nothing else, I can say that I know of no other audio drama that thought to feature a blind main character and make that the crux of why the show is written and structured the way it is. Anytime I can subvert a genre and push it to what I believe are its limits, I'm way happier than if I just create something that nestles into the status quo. Which essentially brings us to today, and the creation of this episode. But stick around after this ad break for one last chapter. We'll be right back. If you must ask the obvious question, then I shall have to answer it simply. I've not outgrown the desire to make an adaptation. In fact, I haven't outgrown it so much that I'm currently working on three. What? I still have to make something that I connect with, which is what each of the scripts I'm working on right now represent. However, unlike my previous aspirations, I am not adapting these stories to film, but rather returning to the format of my very first epic undertaking, my stage adaptation of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I grew up in the theater. Shocking, isn't it? I just fit in naturally on stage, which is weird since I'm supposed to exaggerate on stage, but really it just proved why I'm such a cartoon in real life. But for these upcoming, slash, yet to be produced, slash, still in development, slash, extremely unlikely unless I get the rights adaptations, I don't aspire to be on stage, but rather behind the scenes. If I'm ever on stage, it would mean that someone else is directing the piece. That would make sense for a one-man show. And I do have one of those on my roster, based on Dostoevsky's classic existential short story, The Dream of a Ridiculous Man. For the other two, though, they mean something personal to me. And I have very specific ideas about characterization, design, and even choreography that I would want to further develop with a team of artists and actors behind me. What those adaptations are, I'm going to keep under my belt. All I'm going to say is, if my idea for a musical ever happens, the design team will need to order lots of cans of black paint. But before I go, I will indulge one final goal as an adaptationalist. I just made up a word and I like it. Don't question my vocabulary, I was raised by two English teachers. A few source materials remained of interest to me as I grew. In 2014, for example, I learned a shocking fact about the 1985 adaptation of Michael Ende's classic novel, The Neverending Story. That not only did the movie end, but it ended about halfway through the original novel. Big shock, the rest of the book turned out to be where the story got even more interesting. And also, if ever I try to pull a Christopher Nolan, as in trying to make a war film so that the Academy will stop ignoring me and finally nominate me for Best Director, you can count on that film being based on the stories of The Fighting Newfoundlander. It's one of the only instances where I truly am an unapologetic patriot. And also, I just don't want Canada's only contribution to the World War epic genre to be a melodrama like Passchendaele. But one old habit continues to die hard for me. one classic that still rings loud and clear. One narrative that has been retold many times, but rarely to its full effect. One tale by a man who poured his soul into it in order to save something that mattered to him, and that resonated with broken people estranged from society, whether that be their peers, their mentors, or the church. Les Mis may have popularized him, but for me, what defined him was Notre Dame de Paris, the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Victor Hugo's other classic novel was one of the first books I read on my own time in my university years, and it defined how I felt about Hugo as a storyteller. The timeless story of the oppressed people of Paris, their faults and their sorrows, and the need for Hugo to tell it against the backdrop of one of history's great architectural achievements. For Hugo, the symbol of the church mattered just as much, even more, in fact, than the people who lived and fought in its shadow. For the image of Notre Dame herself is eternal, even if the likes of Frollo, Quasimodo, Esmeralda, and Clopin are a passing memory. Yet how can you forget about them when they are so vivid and their lives are so grueling that you feel the dirt on their faces, the stones beneath their feet, the shame in their hearts, and the yearnings in their souls? It's one of the most profound, beautiful pieces of writing in all of history. This was the epic tale I had always wanted, and it's the last remaining text from my youth that I still yearn to retell in my own way. But why? Why when so many others have? Why when you can't really tell it in a new way? Why when Disney has already turned it into a great-looking but tonally flimsy cartoon? And why still? Even since last year. I've struggled with the answers to these questions a lot. It is true that at least 10 different adaptations already exist. And yet, I still want to make it. There is only one adaptation that I think captures most of what I love about the original novel. Ricardo Cosciante's 1998 French-language stage musical, Notre Dame de Paris.
Il est venu le temps des cathédrales. Le monde est entré.
It doesn't follow the exact events of the novel, but it delves deeper into the original themes than most other adaptations. And perhaps most vitally, especially compared to the Disney film, Notre Dame de Paris retains the novel's original ending. The story of the Hunchback is soaked in tears and blood, and it does not end triumphant. That's the key. I'm advocating that a film follows the source material's original narrative, because only the smallest fraction of the existing adaptations do. I feel more than adamant that of all the prospective adaptations I've discussed here, none has been more set on representing the original story as Hugo had written it. Except for one setback. It may not be until later in life. Not because I'm too young or losing interest, but because I need to see Notre Dame stand tall again. I wrote this part of the script on the 1-year anniversary of the fire that defaced the cathedral. Even for someone who identifies as spiritual more than religious, Notre Dame is like my home. I don't even have to step inside its walls in order to believe that it is my sanctuary. Watching it burn hurt me more than some could believe. On that day, I turned back to the original text, and I couldn't think just about my own feelings, but about everyone who lost a symbol of their faith and their country. I was grateful that several artifacts and one of the rose windows remained intact, and for all the emergency service people who fought against the inferno. But the pain of those millions of people in the streets echoed for weeks afterwards. On that day, for the first time, I felt like I did not have the right to tell the story the way I saw it, since it wasn't just my story. It was Paris's story. It was France's story. And I needed to let them have it again. Maybe one day, when the shock has resided, and the cathedral stands as it once did, then I will return to the book that means so much to me. But the time isn't right yet. Adaptation is something that nearly all film fans are passionate about. I'm sure most writers start their career aspiring to give the world their version of a tale that mattered to them. Some, like me, think it's what's going to transform them into the voice of a generation. Ironic, since you want to do so by recalling the voice of one of your predecessors. But the intent when I started making this show was not to harp on those tales. Rather, I was going to give light to those that define the lives of many different people that have yet to receive the recognition that the fans think that they should. The majority, if not all, the episodes I cover from here on end somehow tie into something that I don't see myself putting a personal stamp on. Not that none of them matter to me, but it's simply that I would rather they either remain as they are, or they get taken on by someone who cares deeply about them, more than perhaps I do. In season 2, I will not be discussing how I would tell these stories, but how someone else might tell them. The theorizing is why we're here. Because even if we, the fans, care about the stories we love, we can never know exactly what will happen to them until they are made into movies. That brings us to the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. Hopefully this was a nice diversion while we all go slightly insane in our houses. As always, if you want to engage with this discussion in any way, if you have a suggestion for what subjects you'd like to hear more about, or what stories I should look into as possible episodes, please let me know. You can follow me on Instagram at DASkyThor. You can like our Facebook page at Adaptational, and you can also send me an email at adaptationalpod@gmail.com. That's adaptation, A-L, pod as in podcast, @gmail.com. Our new theme music comes to us from Donovan Yonk of Mega Hammer Studios. Thank you so much again, my friend. It sounds great. If you need any further distractions in your spare time, you can prepare for season 2 by diving into some of the new source materials I'll be covering. Sample titles are featured on our Facebook page, including novels, 2 video games, and 2 TV series, just to add a bit of variety, as well as some books that you should read even if we might not cover them. We'll be back soon. Keep your ears to the ground so you'll be ready for our official launch date. In the meantime, keep those pages turning, and I'll see you next time on Adaptational.